everybody. It's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. By now, most of us have seen the Oscar-winning movie Oppenheimer, the riveting Christopher Nolan film that tells the story of American Robert Oppenheimer, the physicist who led the scientific team that made the first atomic bomb, a complex man in a complex time. But he was not the only complex genius at Los Alamos in 1944. He was surrounded by them. The movie is based on the book American Prometheus by Kai Bird and Martin Sherwin. Prometheus, for the Greek mythology challenged, was a god whose most noteworthy feat was stealing fire from Olympus and handing it to humans so they could thrive. In other words, he handed over the fire and waited for the fireworks. And they came. Oppenheimer met fellow physicist Klaus Fuchs when the British contingent, who had already been working on the feasibility of nuclear weapons, was brought into the inner workings of the Manhattan Project. The Brits had given the project a running start, and physicist Fuchs was part of the package. While he was not one of the big-name scientists working in New Mexico in the early 1940s, it has never been disputed that his grasp of both mathematics and theoretical physics played an essential role in the development of the atomic bomb. Born in Germany, Fuchs had become a naturalized citizen of Great Britain in 1942. Upon their initial meeting, Oppenheimer, who knew of Fuchs' work but had never met the man, asked him, "Since when are you British?" The bespectacled young man responded, "Since Hitler told me I wasn't German." That sounds like a snappy response now, but Fuchs was not a playful dude. The good Lutheran boy hated Hitler and everything the National Socialists had done to his country, his family, and his friends. In his mind, everything he did at Los Alamos was to beat the Nazis to the punch before they could unlock the secret of the atom for themselves. Fuchs wanted it done fast. He knew the Nazis would destroy what they could not otherwise conquer and leave the world in ruin. He knew the Allies were ahead of Germany in this regard. Hitler's scientists were technically handicapped because he had either run off or imprisoned most of the gifted German physicists, many of whom were Jewish or married to Jewish women, who had the capacity to work on this vexing problem. So yeah, Fuchs worked hard in those frantic war years to defeat the Nazis. It has never been a question if he helped. He did, in ways most of those on the planet could not have begun to. Later, Fuchs would say that his work at Los Alamos wasn't just about defeating the Nazis. It was also about trying to equalize the terrible power he knew atoms held, just waiting to be unleashed. That, he claimed, was why he secretly gave the Soviet Union what was essentially a blueprint for building their own atomic bomb, even as he and his colleagues were still working out the formula. Brilliant, but perhaps naive, one of the world's most gifted physicists became a communist spy because he believed it would equalize the world and bring eternal peace. What a nice idea, in theory. Still, he was no less a traitor of epic proportion, who told everything he knew during a world war. He betrayed everyone he knew, everyone he worked with, and may have altered forever the world that has wrestled with the reality of nuclear warfare ever since. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. You ever hit that point midsummer where you cannot plan one more meal? Like, I'd rather skip dinner than have to figure out what to cook.
When that hits, I get so excited for a Home Chef box to get here.
Me too. We recently had one of their quick 30-minute meals. I think it was the pork medallions with Dijon cream sauce.
The flavors were great. Everything was pre-portioned, so we didn't waste anything.
Home Chef delivers fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience.
Users of leading meal kits have rated Home Chef number one in quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease. You can choose from classic kits, oven-ready meals, microwave meals, or their family menu if you're cooking for a crowd.
And let's be honest, with groceries as expensive as they are right now, the fact that Home Chef customers save an average of $86 a month, that's a big deal.
For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 50% off and free shipping for your first box plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC.
That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life.
Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive the free dessert.
Klaus Fuchs was born in Rüsselsheim, a small town just south of Frankfurt, Germany. His father, Emil, was a Lutheran rector of Quaker stock, a left-wing social democrat who was active politically at a time when, if you lived in Germany, it was dangerous to be. Nancy Thorndike Greenspan, author of Atomic Spy, The Dark Lives of Klaus Fuchs, explains,
"The father was extremely liberal. He was a minister and he was in the very conservative Lutheran church. And his mission in life was to support the working class. He was a socialist. He joined the Social Democratic Party. He wasn't a communist. There were very distinct, strong distinctions between those two things. All of his children became socialists. Whereas Klaus was extremely reserved, his father was very outspoken, but they both had the same steely, unbending determination inside."
Emil and his wife Elsa were all in on the rights of the working man and the power that trade unions promised, to the point that the conservative, capitalist church Emil worked for fired him. But after backlash from his congregation, they reinstated him. One of four children, Fuchs was exceedingly bright and, early on, recognized for his mathematical prowess. Like his siblings, he was raised to be politically aware and active. He was just 16 in 1927 when Adolf Hitler was making a name for himself in the National Socialist German Workers' Party, a right-wing party with a democracy-flavored name that was actually packed with anti-Semites, fascists, and violent psychopaths. They were doing well, rising in the eyes of the German public, because Germany was still reeling from World War I when the 1929 Wall Street crash began to reverberate around the world. Hitler's promises to end unemployment and make Germany great again started sounding awfully appealing to a lot of people. By 1930, Fuchs was at the University of Leipzig and openly a member of the Socialist Student Union, who, with the students who professed to be communists, opposed this new brand of German who called themselves Nazis and tended to bully and beat their way forward into what they imagined to be a different kind of future. Over the next few years, Fuchs became a full-blown activist and a leader on campus, organizing protests against the growing radicalization of German society. The Nazis weren't exactly into peaceful debate, so campus clashes turned violent, and more often than not, Fuchs and his side got their butts handed to them. And it wasn't just Klaus taking the hits. His three siblings were just as committed, maybe even more so, thanks to their father's relentless push to stand up for what they believed, body and soul. On a Biographics YouTube documentary, host Eric Malachite explained how far that went.
Political demonstrations and meetings of this period were often accompanied by vicious street fighting, particularly between the Nazis and the communists. Klaus had 3 front teeth knocked out in 1 brawl and was nearly killed in another one when he was beaten and thrown into a river.
His mother could not manage these tumultuous times, and on October 9, 1931, she died by suicide. The death notice read, quote, "We ask you to refrain from condolences. Even flowers are not in her nature. Whoever wants to commemorate her, befriend those who are in need," end quote. Her death served to encourage her children to do more. As Greenspan wrote, quote, "All 4 of the Fuchs children saw a world urgently in need of reform. Their perception of the woes of the working class and the success of the capitalists riding on its back shaped their lives and individual action," end quote. Fuchs was totally committed to fairness, she wrote. He was just also shockingly, breathtakingly, and astonishingly good at mathematics and physics and mechanical engineering and saw how they all worked together to explain the universe. He saw no reason to give up his political activity for his studies. He could do both. Things were getting very bad in Germany. In early 1933, Hitler had won more electoral support, had been appointed chancellor, and immediately started cracking down, banning meetings and publications that he considered a public threat to Nazi power. Soon enough, the communists were hounded into hiding. Then Hitler went after the Jews, and the Fuchs siblings fled to Berlin, trying to stay effective even as they were forced underground. Klaus barely escaped. Just hours before the Gestapo was set to knock on his door to arrest him, he boarded a train to France, fleeing a regime that surely would have killed him. After a brief respite in Paris, he took a ferry to England. He carried almost no luggage, no money, no prospects for work, and no real safety net. Just a few friends and a community in crisis. Oh, and he was just 21. What he did have was a letter saying he'd been offered the chance to study theoretical physics with Ronald Gunn at the University of Bristol. It even promised room and board. His father had sent money ahead to cover his tuition. The British authorities let him in, at least for now. In 1934, when Fuchs had to renew his status in the UK, things got weird. Germany said he could come back, but Fuchs figured that was a trap. In England, authorities started getting nervous about his nationality status, and lo, MI5, the UK's domestic security agency, think FBI, opened a file on him. A chief constable wrote a letter that went into the file stating that Fuchs was a, quote, "notorious communist," end quote, though the letter also noted Fuchs hadn't done much political work or caused any disturbance while in Bristol. Which is kind of impressive. I mean, the world's falling apart, Hitler and Mussolini are rising, the Spanish Civil War is heating up, and this guy's got the time and energy to pay attention to all of that while doing groundbreaking work on electrical conductivity. But things weren't settling down. Fuchs got word that his brother, Gerard, and his sister, Elizabeth, had been arrested by the Gestapo for their political activities. So now he started working back channels to get word to or from them. Somehow in the middle of all this, he managed to stay focused. In 1935, he published his first scientific paper, A Quantum Mechanical Investigation of Cohesive Forces of Metallic Copper Metals. It helped lay the groundwork for his mentor, Neil Mott, to later win a Nobel Prize. Also during this time, Fuchs studied Marxist philosophy, attended meetings of the Friends of Soviet Russia, and was an active member of the Society for Cultural Relations with the Soviet Union. According to Robert Chadwell Williams' book, Klaus Fuchs, Atom Spy, Fuchs even took part in some political theater. Literally, he staged dramatic readings of Stalin's purge trials. Interestingly, Fuchs always took the role of the prosecutor in these readings and, according to those who knew him at the time, delivered the accusations, quote, with a cold venom that I would never have suspected from so quiet and retiring a young man, end quote. In 1937, Fuchs' mentor shipped him off to the University of Edinburgh to study theoretical physics with Max Born, another future Nobel Prize winner. Born told him to cool it with all the political stuff and focus on quantum mechanics. Fuchs said he would. He didn't. Though he wasn't showy, he had gone out of his way to keep up with his German communist pals, now living in London. One of them, an economic statistician named Jürgen Kuczynski, had arrived a year earlier and wasted no time organizing the group into a propaganda machine aimed at undermining the Reich from abroad. Fuchs didn't just lend a hand, he was deep in it, pulling his weight and then some. And here's where the spy files start to thicken. The Kuczynski family had been on MI6's radar since 1928, MI6 being the British equivalent of the CIA. They were dropped into what was called a KAOT file. That's K-A-E-O-T, short for keep an eye on them. Eventually, that became known simply as a K file. And when the Kuczynskis arrived in England, anyone who regularly associated with them got filed too. That included Fuchs. But he may not have cared. The world had changed forever for him by then. Biographics host Eric Malachite again.
The Fuchs family paid a heavy price for their anti-Nazi activities. By 1939, three of the four Fuchs children were in exile from Germany, including Klaus, while the fourth, Elisabeth, committed suicide by throwing herself out of a train.
Just before Hitler invaded Poland on September 1st, 1939, Fuchs decided to apply to become a naturalized British citizen, but missed the deadline. That meant he was now officially considered an enemy alien, which doesn't sound great. But Fuchs had decent timing in other ways. He landed a prestigious Carnegie grant and started digging into quantum dynamics and statistical mechanics. His research was turning heads, especially among officials who were starting to think Britain ought to hang on to its smartest minds. All this disruption of his politics by his science or vice versa would have derailed most of us. Fuchs hardly noticed. He would later say, proudly I guess, that he had an ability to compartmentalize his brain and his life. He called it controlled schizophrenia. Work was work, resistance was resistance. He could make sure they did not leak into one another. Until, of course, they did. But not yet. For now, the German army were on a roll, taking the Netherlands without much trouble, something that immediately spurred the British to round up their quote-unquote aliens and throw them into an internment camp in Edinburgh. That included Fuchs. As Greenspan explains in her book, quote, in the eyes of the officials at Whitehall, Fuchs and others were no longer refugees from Nazi oppression, but likely Nazi saboteurs, end quote. So the brilliant physicist was put behind barbed wire fences, a man without a country, living in desolate, dirty, and despairing conditions. The food where he was interred was inedible, communication with the outside world non-existent. Then, just as quickly, things shifted. Fuchs was transferred to the Isle of Man, where the internment camp was, well, still a prison, but a nicer one. The detainees, mostly exiled German intellectuals, spent their days giving lectures to each other on everything from theology to literature to vector analysis. That last one was Fuchs' domain. Then they were shipped to Canada along with German prisoners of war. It was July 1940 and the Canadians had agreed to this internment idea because their mother country told them that these men were, quote, so dangerous in attitude and design that their presence in England at a time of threatened invasion was a menace to the safety of the nation, end quote. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Galatea. You know that moment when you finally get 5 quiet minutes to yourself and your phone is like, here's the news, the group chat, and 10 spam emails?
Yeah, that's when you quietly disappear and start reading again, isn't it?
Exactly. I've been using this app called Galatea, and it's been great for escaping into a good story without having to scroll through the nonsense.
You've been saying it's got a ton of stuff. Romance, fantasy, drama.
Yeah, there are literally over 1,000 stories in there, from bad boy billionaires to forbidden love, teen drama, slow burn fantasy. Whatever mood you're in, it's got something binge-worthy, and they drop new stories and chapters every week.
Right now, Galatea is offering our listeners an extra 25% off on top of an already irresistibly affordable subscription when you go to galatea.com/COTC.
That's galatea.com/COTC to indulge in unlimited stories for even less.
Galatea.com/COTC.
More than 700 men lived in sheds that had been built to house trains, with just 5 faucets and 6 toilets to serve them all. Fuchs was not one to rot in horrible conditions, be labeled a German prisoner, and let it slide. He helped organize protests and reached out to anyone he thought could do something about the preposterous position they were in. This wasn't about toilet paper. The inmates feared they'd be pawns in a prisoner trade and then sent back to Germany to be executed. The bad situation got even worse when the enemy aliens were divided into Aryan and Jewish camps. The Jews, who were called the kosher group, got the worst of it. Stuck in a sopping, stinking, fetid area, they were left in long abandoned buildings with no access to decent rations or heat. Conditions were so bad, some begged to be put in with the Nazi prisoners, who surely had it better. That the so-called enemy aliens were treated no better than the Nazis who had been captured on the battlefield appalled Fuchs to such an extent that historians believe it was a turning point for the physicist. He saw the Allied forces, America had not yet entered the war, as little better than the fascists they were fighting. He began to believe that the goal wasn't liberation, it was attrition. Let Germany and Russia destroy each other, and the British, French, and Americans would inherit the wreckage. In the camps, he was thrown in with many who believed as he did, as well as with those who had even deeper communist leanings. It's hard not to see his point. Of the 70,000 German refugees reviewed as potential threats to the British public, only 569 were ever interred. Fuchs was one of them. A thinking man, which he was many times over, would reasonably ask, why me? Still, the British government had public support. In fact, when polled about their reaction to the strict internment policies, 43% of Britons said they wanted everyone who had ever been German and lived within the empire to be behind bars. Of course, these were people getting bombed nightly. Invasion felt imminent. And it's not like the U.S. gets to judge. After Pearl Harbor, we threw 120,000 Japanese Americans into camps, 70,000 of whom were U.S. citizens, and kept them there the rest of the war. So, no, there's no high horse to mount here. Though, admittedly, Britain calmed itself down much faster. Almost as quickly as they'd been rousted into camps, Fuchs, along with others, was released, allowed to return to England when authorities adjudged him anti-Nazi and recognized that his particular scientific knowledge could safely help the war effort. London had survived the Blitz. The war was shifting. Fuchs had spent 8 months in disillusionment, though it's debatable whether he'd ever been particularly enchanted with capitalism in the first place. But he was still in love with math, with physics, with what they could do. And if ever there was a man perfectly positioned to betray the Allies' most classified nuclear secrets for the benefit of the proletariat, it was this guy. Here's some science I'm going to breeze through so you know where that stands in very late 1939 and early 1940. Danish physicist Niels Bohr, Nobel Prize winner, atomic structure unlocker extraordinaire, had spent the 1920s building models of the atom. Once the neutron was discovered, he incorporated it into those models. Soon after, scientists realized atomic nuclei could disintegrate and magnetic fields could be used to accelerate particles. Then, in 1938, three German scientists fired a neutron into a uranium atom and split it. Nuclear fission was born, unleashing a ridiculous amount of energy. And voila, all the elements of a mega-destructive atomic bomb were in place. If only the science could be harnessed to that end. So the question being asked as 1940 dawned were, theoretically, did it make sense? Technically, was it feasible? Morally, was it acceptable to try? I mean, it was a hell of a time to be asked to make moral decisions. In early 1939, two German refugee scientists in England, Otto Frisch and Rudolf Piles, sent a memo to Winston Churchill's chief science advisor. The title said it all. On the construction of a superbomb based on nuclear chain reaction in uranium. Naturally, a committee was formed. By summer, Britain was sharing its findings with the Americans, and Frisch and Piles got the go-ahead to try and make this superbomb real. 6 months after being released from his internment camp, Klaus Fuchs got invited to join the effort. Piles knew he was a communist and didn't care. The work was too important, and the urgency was real. The code name given the nuclear weapons project was Tube Alloys, which sounds to me like an IUD, but I digress. Fuchs was technically still an enemy alien, so they found a workaround. He was hired as a consultant, which let him work on top-secret stuff under minimum disclosure rules. Then, per protocol, he was asked to sign the British Official Secrets Act, which meant that he acknowledged any disclosure of sensitive government information regarding defense, foreign policy, national security, and intelligence to anyone without permission would result in prison or worse. Now, instead of pretending I understand any of the nuclear science he worked on, I'm going to cheat and let Biographics host Eric Malachite explain it.
One of the most important problems Fuchs worked on was how to acquire enough nuclear material to make a bomb with it. Only 0.7% of natural uranium is made up of the isotope U-235, which is the only uranium isotope that triggers a chain reaction of nuclear fission large enough to set off an atomic explosion, and uranium itself was already hard to come by, with most of the world's supply coming from a single mine in the Belgian Congo. The answer was a gaseous diffusion plant, where uranium gas is pumped through filters in order to separate the microscopic amounts of U-235 from the rest of the material. Fuchs worked on the theoretical calculations that examined which types of filters and how many thousands of times the gas needed to pass through them in order to create a pure sample of U-235, among many other questions.
Then Hitler, in a surprise attack, invaded the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941. 3 months later, the German army was a few miles from Moscow, and Klaus Fuchs, if he had not admitted it to himself before, now knew exactly what he was going to do. By that fall, Fuchs asked his friend, Jürgen Kaczynski, with whom he now shared friends in the communist community, how he could help the Soviet Union. "Go meet some people at the Soviet embassy," Kaczynski said. "And, oh, by the way, my sister Ursula, a Red Army lieutenant, lives here in London, should you need her." When Fuchs went to the embassy, biographer Williams wrote, he explained he had, quote, "important information about an Anglo-American war project that could lead to a powerful new weapon," end quote, and he wanted to share this information with Russia. And so it began. Fuchs was assigned a control, a handler to whom he would pass information, who would then route it to Moscow. That control's name was Alexander, and he just so happened to be Kaczynski's sister's husband. 6 months later, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. The U.S. was now in the war. And even though the British were ahead on all things atomic bomb, the collaborative project was moved to America to protect it from German bombs, to have better access to raw materials, and where security was tighter. Well, in theory at least. President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill decided there was no need to loop in their ally, Joseph Stalin, on this little side project, you know, the one involving the most powerful weapon in human history. German physicists, meanwhile, plowed forward on their own nuclear weapon track using a different approach based on something called heavy water. It didn't hurt that Fuchs and Piles and others in the Allied camp could read the German scientific papers and know what they were up to. And it was very up-to-date intel, as the British had a spy inside the Nazi bomb and rocket effort to provide it. In the meantime, MI6 had asked few questions about the German refugee geniuses working on the Allies' behalf. They ultimately okayed the bunch to do the top-secret work. This, mind you, was barely 18 months after Fuchs had been locked up as a supposed national security threat. In a documentary entitled Cold War Secrets: Stealing the Atomic Bomb, it's made clear that for the Manhattan Project, scientists were evaluated on their technical and mathematical prowess alone. And it's reasonable to imagine that the British Secret Service did not consider communism, such as it was, to be the ultimate evil yet. Socialism and communism, in theory, were about collective ownership, sharing land, labor, and resources for the good of all, instead of leaving everything to private control. But, of course, that's not how things actually played out. Between 1936 and 1938, Joseph Stalin directed the deaths of between 700,000 and 1.2 million people who had been tortured and put on trial and convicted without due process. That number included landowning farmers, political opponents, and ethnic minorities. How much of that Fuchs truly understood is anyone's guess. But what we do know is this. He was regularly meeting with Ursula Kuczynski, later to be known as the Cold War's most effective spymaster, in her guises as Ruth Werner, Ursula Hamburger, Ruth Bjerten, or Agent Sonja, to pass along what he knew. When the British scientists were transferred to the U.S. to join the Manhattan Project, Fuchs was handed off to a new handler, an American codenamed Raymond. His real name? Harry Gold. The U.S. military wasn't thrilled about how many of the Los Alamos scientists leaned left politically. But this was war, and they needed every brain they could get. There were no replacements. Which didn't mean they did not do background checks. They did. But only on the Americans. They trusted the British to do their own. Even the Manhattan Project's head man, Robert Oppenheimer, was closely scrutinized by the War Department and the FBI. During the Depression, he had been radicalized, dabbling in campus communism, though he never officially joined the party. He was not unlike many of his generation. His wife Kitty had once been a party member and made no secret of her political leanings. Maybe it's time to ask an obvious question. Why did the Soviets need help building an atomic bomb? They had great physicists too. Yeah, but they also had German soldiers at that very moment on their home soil, and the western parts of the country had been nearly destroyed in the first Nazi onslaught. So really, their work from 1942 on depended largely on what they got from Fuchs, who, while in the U.S., but not yet at Los Alamos, was conferring with a wide array of physicists who gave him much information about the doings at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where uranium was being enriched, and Hanford, Washington, where plutonium was being produced. When 32-year-old Fuchs got to the Los Alamos site in late summer 1944, scientific director Oppenheimer had recently shifted gears. The uranium-based bomb was moving too slowly, so he prioritized a second approach, plutonium. Oppenheimer decided that, and I'm gonna let biographics Malachite do the honors again with the sciencey stuff.
Manhattan Project scientists needed to switch their efforts to a bomb made using plutonium, a material much easier to produce in large quantities. This required a completely different bomb design in order to make it work, however, which required more complex calculations. Fuchs was considered vital to this new initiative. The only theoretical physicist who was actively working on the designs for the explosive lenses that would surround the plutonium core of the bomb. All of the lenses needed to go off at precisely the same moment in order to create the chain reaction needed to ignite the plutonium, otherwise the result would be a much less powerful explosion. Not only was his work important, but he got along well with his colleagues, who together represented some of the foremost concentrations of scientific talent ever assembled in one place.
But in an effort to foster camaraderie, Oppenheimer wanted to offer cross-pollination of all disciplines so that, for really the first time, the left hand knew what the right hand was doing. That meant that Oppenheimer held seminars on certain problems that any scientist stationed at the secured makeshift town could attend. Such great collaboration, such great opportunity to take notes on every detail of other people's work. And Fuchs was a quiet participant in almost all of them. He was, after all, a worker bee among the biggest names in their fields. A dozen of them already had Nobel Prizes. So yeah, he was a very hardworking, exceptionally brilliant guy. He was even named to head the theoretical physics division of the British nuclear research effort. But he was not showy or especially extraordinary in this company, which suited him just fine. Having taken good notes, he made regular trips in his old Buick into Santa Fe or Albuquerque, or the hills in between, to meet with Gold and hand over calculations, explanations, schematics, whatever he could that showed the progress of the project. On July 16, 1945, when the first atomic test, codenamed Trinity, was carried out in the New Mexico desert, Fuchs was there, goggles on, watching history change. This is audio from the actual test, with narration, likely by Westbrook Van Voorhees, the legendary broadcast journalist.
A flare in the sky signaled the final countdown.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, now.
The flash was later calculated to be brighter than 1,000 suns. Miles away, a young girl, blind from birth, saw the flash. Men at the site felt the heat of a desert sun. Then came the shockwave. 2 GIs at the command center stood up in their excitement at seeing the boiling cloud and were knocked to the ground. The roar followed, a cascading thunderclap that rolled and boomed out across the desert.
The desert lit up, the shockwave hit. And the secrets Fuchs had quietly gathered would soon help another superpower to do the same. Of course, by then, the Germans had already surrendered, Hitler was dead, and Fuchs believed there was no need to use the gadgets they'd created. But he would have no say. Just one day after the Trinity test, President Harry Truman arrived in Potsdam to meet with Churchill and Stalin. On July 24th, Truman pulled Stalin aside and casually mentioned that the U.S. had developed, quote, a new weapon of unusual destructive force, end quote. It made for a strange dynamic, strange because Stalin had known about the atomic bomb's developing progress since late 1941, thanks to Fuchs and Agent Sonya. 3 weeks later, 2 bombs were dropped, one uranium bomb over Hiroshima, one plutonium bomb over Nagasaki. Fuchs had worked on both. At one point, he naively told Harry Gold he didn't think the British had any idea about his past. He hoped to return to Germany, find his father, if he was still alive, and start over. That time had come. Fuchs hung around a bit, leaving the United States in late June 1946 after completing some mop-up work. Science, you know, is an ongoing discipline. He returned a hero. He got an offer to work at Britain's Atomic Energy Research Establishment because he was now seen worldwide as a top-drawer theoretical physicist who had helped save the world from fascism. His new post was in the village of Harwell, which is what everyone, by default, called the facility, a town that was built but a stone's throw from Oxford. Working there at the time was Freeman Dyson, a British-American theoretical physicist and mathematician whose work spanned quantum field theory, astrophysics, mathematical formulation of quantum mechanics, condensed matter physics, nuclear physics, and engineering. Whew, let me catch my breath. So yeah, these were some seriously gifted people. Anyway, according to Dyson,
Fuchs came to the house several times while I was there, and he was always a welcome guest, and he was very, very nice. I mean, we all felt very fond of him. He was a very gracious guest, and he was a lonely fellow. He was at Harwell at that time running the theoretical division. But he liked to come to Birmingham, and he and Piles, of course, had been old colleagues, and so they were very close. And he loved the Piles children. He was very good with the children. Altogether, just a sort of a friendly uncle type of person.
A friendly guy, then, who had no idea that, in the fall of 1949, British code decryption specialists were still at work deciphering messages that had been intercepted by the Signal Intelligence Service during the war. One recently decrypted message, intercepted 5 years earlier as it passed between Soviet embassies in New York and Moscow, revealed something explosive. A British scientist working in America had been leaking nuclear secrets to the Soviets. Then, on August 29th, 1949, confirmation came. The Soviets had tested their own atomic bomb, and it worked. Suddenly, the timeline made sense. The question wasn't how they had pulled it off so fast. The question was, who helped them? Back in Britain, Scotland Yard didn't take long to land on a prime suspect. Within days, Klaus Fuchs was under intense surveillance. His movements were tracked. His mail was inspected. But nothing concrete turned up. He'd been assigned a new Soviet handler, codenamed Eugene, and hadn't stopped passing along information. But Fuchs wasn't reckless. He knew the jig might be up. Meanwhile, American military officials were bragging to the press that the U.S. would dominate the next 100 years. Scientists, though, were doing the math. They figured it should have taken the Soviets a decade to catch up. But now, in the open plains of Kazakhstan, the playing field had leveled, which, for Fuchs, had been the point all along. No one really knows exactly how much Klaus Fuchs gave away in intel to the Soviets, but there's little reason to believe he held much back. He had never made a penny from it. In fact, it has never been alleged that he prospered from his treachery. So, did it matter? Did what Fuchs divulged actually change history? That's a question for the ages. Because some argue if the Soviets had taken, say, 5 or 6 more years to develop the weapon, the U.S. would have been the sole nuclear power through most of the 1950s. Truman could have easily decided to unleash that weapon on North Korea or even China during the Korean conflict, which this country engaged in between 1950 and 1953. Fuchs had never, ever hidden the fact that he was an avowed protest-organizing, propaganda-creating communist when that was seen by many as a viable alternative to capitalism, and was, in theory, better for the working man. Still, back then, being a communist meant tying oneself to the Eurasian mega-country known as the Soviet Union, a country that was really the only plausible equal to the United States in what everyone knew post-war would be a fight for world dominance. So why was Klaus Fuchs allowed anywhere near the Manhattan Project? Why was he allowed access to the very secret that Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill had deliberately kept from Joseph Stalin? It's not like British intelligence didn't know. MI5 and MI6 were aware of his communist ties before he even arrived in the UK in 1933. They had access to a Gestapo report, acquired by a German agent turned British spy, that identified Fuchs as a Communist Party worker in Germany. So, why did they keep greenlighting him? Why did they let him near the crown jewels of classified science? And why, when the news finally broke, were so many of his colleagues at Los Alamos stunned to learn that he, quiet, polite, brilliant Fuchs, had leaked the biggest secret of the 20th century? obvious questions. The answers, maybe less so. Maybe the British were just in a hurry, or maybe desperate times call for desperate measures, or maybe the British intelligence was just incompetent. Or was there something more nefarious going on? Did certain British left-leaning officials high up in the British intelligence service fear that telling what they knew about Fuchs would unravel their own secrets, their own treason? Or maybe the world was just being naive, because Fuchs didn't look like a spy. In late 1949, just before his 38th birthday, he was called in by Scotland Yard Inspector William Scarden, who told him flat out he was suspected of passing nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union. Fuchs denied it. But he did say something curious, that if circumstances ever mirrored what had happened in Germany in the early 1930s, he would act, quote, on a loyalty which he owed to humanity in general, end quote. That stuck with Scarden. He wasn't convinced, and he didn't let it go. The pressure built, and it ate at Fuchs. According to Nancy Thorndike Greenspan, the biographer,
another friend had convinced him that he had to confess to make sure his friends didn't fall under suspicion.
And so, a few weeks later, Fuchs did confess. He told Scarden he had given the Soviets all the information he had about building the bomb. And he described how, from the very first meeting with Harry Gold, quote, I had continuous contact with persons who were completely unknown to me, except that I knew they would hand whatever information I gave them to Russian authorities, end quote. And yet, he seemed to equivocate and minimize a bit, saying that the worst he had done was give information about the principles of the design of the plutonium bomb. Some biographers believe Fuchs didn't expect to be arrested, much less prosecuted for his crime. But on February 2, 1950, he was arrested. His colleagues were, as the British say, gobsmacked. Freeman Dyson remembered how hard it hit his mentor, Rudolf Piles, the man who had first vouched for Fuchs. The woman he mentions, named Genia, was Dr. Piles' wife.
I mean, that was a terrible shock, of course. And suddenly it turned out he was not only just a spy, but the spy. I mean, he was the number one spy. And and it was, for Piles personally, it was a terrible betrayal. I mean, Piles had been responsible for bringing him to Los Alamos in the first place. And England had become untrustworthy, not just Fuchs. And Genia was absolutely vitriolic. I mean, that a man could do that to his friends. And she always said, in Russia, we know how to suffer. We don't betray our friends. And Piles went to visit Fuchs from time to time. Genia absolutely refused to have anything to do with him.
In March 1950, Fuchs stood trial. To avoid disclosing still classified information, the Chief Justice read out four charges. 90 minutes later, it was done. The judge said Fuchs had done irreparable harm to both Britain and the United States. The crime he was convicted of, that of breaching the oath he had taken not to divulge state secrets, was, according to the judge, only thinly differentiated from high treason. High treason would have meant execution. But under British law, it didn't qualify. The Soviet Union had technically been an ally at the time the information was passed. Fuchs was sentenced to 14 years in prison. John Wheeler, an American theoretical physicist who was later dubbed the Dean of the Black Hole, was speaking at a post-war conference on nuclear safety when he voiced one of his biggest fears.
The thing you've got to worry about most is that what's the chance somebody who comes in, who's an expert, who's trusted, and who gets by only security guards because he's trusted, but who knows technically how to turn off this different safety devices, and somebody animated by some strange ideology. And as I was speaking, opposite me in the British group was Klaus Fuchs, and 1 month later, he was in prison, not because of any action in this committee, but because evidence of his being a spy. But Sir Rudolf Parles, who had hired him, went around to the prison to see him. He said, there's some terrible mistake. we've got to get you a lawyer. And Luke said, no, it's not a mistake. You mean you were a spy? Yes, but how could you? Well, I meant to give control of the world to the Russians.
Fuchs served only 9 of the 14 years, having been released early for good behavior. He then made his way back to his father in East Germany, where he lived until his death in 1988. Long honored there for being one of the world's greatest scientists, he was given a state funeral. Attending that day was a 35-year-old KGB agent. His name was Vladimir Putin. Back in the U.S., Harry Gold, a.k.a. Raymond, Fuchs' handler, confessed to his role in things in May 1950. That led to David Greenglass, a U.S. Army machinist who passed information through his sister and brother-in-law, Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. Greenglass testified that Ethel typed his notes and Julius handed them off to Soviet agents. The U.S. didn't care whether the Soviet Union was an ally at the time. The Rosenbergs were convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage and executed in 1953. To learn more about their case, head to Season 1, Episode 3 of this podcast. Decades later, declassified documents and historians widely concluded that Ethel, mother of 2 young boys, was likely innocent, and the info the couple supposedly passed along was largely useless. Greenglass served 10 years of a 15-year sentence and died in 2014 at age 92. Now look, it's been hard to wade through the science in this story, but that's nothing compared to the politics. For starters, the cryptography work that exposed Fuchs in 1949 created a problem. The US and UK didn't want the Soviets to know they were still reading their mail. So the prosecution had to tread lightly to try not to spill too many beans while cleaning up the stove. And there's still debate over whether Fuchs slipped through so many cracks because exposing him earlier might have exposed others. 5 high-ranking British agents were later unmasked as Soviet spies. And yes, Fuchs' file passed through their hands. Very sticky wicket, this. The Soviets later claimed Los Alamos leaked like a sieve, and honestly, that might not have been wrong. With 130,000 people involved across multiple sites, it's not shocking there were other spies, other couriers, other secrets. Even Oppenheimer was once asked by a communist sympathizer if he wanted to pass info along to Moscow. That would be treason, he responded. The Soviets, for their part, never named their sources. But we now know that Theodore Hall, a Harvard graduate at 18, walked into the Soviet embassy in 1944 and laid out key details about critical mass studies. And Bruno Pontecorvo, assistant to Nobel laureate Enrico Fermi, defected in 1950 and was later honored in the USSR with a physics prize bearing his name. As for Fuchs, he was recruited in 1941 to the theoretical physics division by Hans Bethe, who later called him, quote, the only physicist I know to have truly changed history, end quote. Maybe, but I think he forgets that Oppenheimer and the vast array of others involved at Los Alamos, Oak Ridge, Hanford, and Chicago also irrevocably and substantially changed history on the day the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And finally, one last detail, because sometimes history hands you the perfect metaphor. The German word Fuchs, it translates to fox, as in the one in the hen house. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Nancy Thorndike Greenspan's Atomic Spy and Robert Chadwell Williams' Klaus Fuchs' Atom Spy. She also listened to a lot of scientists talk about him, which was much more interesting than listening to the biographers, but she did that too. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Ben Scoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.